welcome to Popcorn Science. In this podcast, we take a critical look at the science portrayed in our favorite movies and television shows. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Catherine Niche. I'm a planetary geologist and a fan of pop culture.
And I'm Dr. John Moores, a professor of space engineering at York University, a planetary atmospheric scientist, and a speculative fiction nerd. And this week, the movie that we're looking at is actually my choice. I figured it's the middle of summer here in Ontario, so that makes it the perfect time for a little bit of film noir, or should I say future noir. So we're looking at Blade Runner, an iconic film from the early 1980s this week. Now, this is the point where we would normally give you a synopsis of the film, but does Blade Runner really have a coherent story? There have been 7 different theatrical releases associated with this particular film, and it's changed a fair bit in between the different releases. And just to, you know, emphasize that really dislocating feeling, Catherine and I even intentionally watched different versions of the film. So I can tell you that I watched the final cut. Catherine, which one did you listen to?
I watched the original 1982 theatrical release.
Ah, so you had the voiceovers.
I did. Yes, there were a lot of voiceovers.
Interesting. This is going to be fun. So to give you just the quick rundown here, you've got a possibly human detective hunting down these replicants, which are really biological androids, and they've escaped from off-world service. They've come back to the Earth and they're searching for their maker, Eldon Tyrell. And what they want to do is to extend the 4-year lifespan that they have.
Is this to be an empathy test? Capillary dilation of the so-called blush response? Fluctuation of the pupil? Involuntary dilation of the iris?
We call it Voight Kampff for short.
So as we sort of move along that little thread, we consider themes like, what is it that makes us human in this kind of vision, this dystopic vision of a future Los Angeles that really, as it turns, very sumptuous, but also very gritty. And you can almost taste the atmosphere. I mean, the PM 2.5 level is insane in this movie. And, you know, with that whole thing really iconically scored by Vangelis, truly Blade Runner is really more of a vibe as these things go. So let me just start with Catherine before I give you my history with this film. So what's your history with this one?
Well, yeah, mine will be pretty short because I don't actually remember when I first saw Blade Runner. It's all very murky. I do recall seeing the sequel, Blade Runner 2049, in the theaters when it came out, but even that was kind of hazy. So I don't have a strong connection to this movie overall.
Yeah, mine is a little bit more in depth. Here's my nerd credentials coming through. When I was 17, I went to something called a math camp that Memorial University of Newfoundland and St. John's held for, you know, people who had done well in math competitions and whatnot. And essentially what happened, you would go to the university, you would have some lectures by math professors, you get a free math book, and you get to stay overnight in the dorms. The 2 years that I did it, we had the same two films. It was 1982 Blade Runner, 1984 Dune. Entertainingly, both of these were originally supposed to be directed by Ridley Scott. In the end, he dropped off of Dune and David Lynch did that one. But I did find it interesting that Denis Villeneuve now, who's a Quebec director, has remade both of those, or made sequel to Blade Runner and then remade the Dune series. So I didn't see him at the math camp, but maybe he was there too. So Blade Runner's sort of been there in the background for me. And I remember this video game adaptation that came out in the late 90s as well, where depending on how you played, you could have all these different endings, and that was supposed to be very cool at the time.
When was the math camp? When did you go to math camp?
Oh, this was in the sort of mid to late 90s.
And they were still playing like a decades-old movie? That seems surprising. There were a lot of good sci-fi movies from the 90s.
But there's this cult following for Blade Runner. I mean, it got a theatrical release in 2007, for goodness sake. And by that point, you know, we're not really heading for that kind of 2019, you know, getting a little bit more certain. But it's this really interesting piece of art, right, that this
it
movie
is. It does seem like more art than a movie. It's kind of a boring movie, I have to say, John. I was kind of getting lost there at the end and like just started Googling stuff on my computer because the ending was so slow. And yeah, as you say, it's more of an art piece than a movie. I think I really enjoy movies where you get a deep dive into characters and it's really a character story, where this, you know, that was like put to the side almost. And it focused more just on the look of the movie than any compelling character story. And so I think that's why I got a little bored by the end. It's also, I think, why I liked the sequel a bit better. I thought they did a better job in Blade Runner 2049 in trying to delve a little bit deeper into the characters.
Yeah, really, there are definitely some of those movies out there where you can't sort of put it on your iPad while you're making supper. It has to be like after midnight. It has to be in an immersive theater that's otherwise dark. This one is one of those. You want to experience that atmosphere, and stuff happens. And, you know, there's things to think about that they give you, but it's not a character story. It's not a plot-driven story. It's a different sort of thing. By the way, Waterworld works really well that way, too. You wouldn't imagine, but it does.
It's been a while since I've seen that movie. That's a Kevin Costner one, right?
It is. Maybe that's coming up next year, folks.
Yeah. And even so, like, Harrison Ford was very big in the 80s, right? Like, he had just done Star Wars.
Oh, goodness.
He had just done Indiana Jones. And by chance, I happened to watch Temple of Doom, like, a week ago. And he was much more compelling as Indiana Jones. He almost seemed bored in this movie. And maybe that's because he and the director didn't get along very well. I read a lot about the conflict on set, and so maybe he wasn't doing his best work. But yeah, all the characters just kind of seem disengaged.
It's amazing that such an interesting piece of art came out of that production, because there's so much lore around Blade Runner now. The version that I had actually came with a 3.5-hour documentary, which I was not able to consume entirely. You know, Catherine and I, we still have jobs. And yeah, it sounds like Harrison Ford did not love being on this movie. I mean, he was a professional. You know, he did the best job he could, but he wasn't really taken in by it. There were challenges with the crew. There were challenges with the production and with the financing and with the screenplay. And everybody was annoyed and pissed off and angry by the end of it and had enough. But apparently they decided to keep doing this every few years because of the interest that was out there.
Yeah, although it didn't do well at the box office either, you know, which is interesting. I think part of that was timing. It came out 2 weeks after E.T. So would you rather see this cute, cuddly little alien or this dystopian future? And so I think it didn't click with audiences in 1982. So I'm not sure where the cult following came from, but I guess there are a lot of nerds out there.
Yeah, there's a few of us. So why don't we go ahead and we'll jump into the science gripes. And since it's at its core an atmospheric movie, why don't we start talking about the rain and the darkness?
Well, right. That was the first thing that really struck me. In every outdoor scene in Blade Runner, it's raining. But it's set in Los Angeles. And anyone who's ever been to Los Angeles will know that it's sunny and dry. I looked it up. It only sees 34 days of precipitation annually, totaling like 2 meters of rain total. And the wettest month is December. But even in December, it only rains 8 days out of the month. So it'd be incredibly improbable that you would go to LA and it would rain every day. And this was set in the future, obviously. Maybe they thought, oh, climate change will change the weather. But climate change will only make LA drier. It shouldn't make it wetter. So the weather was very bizarre and kind of took me out of the setting, right? Why did they set it in Los Angeles and then have it rain all the time? Do it in Seattle or something like that.
I mean, you are forgetting, of course, the scene where it snowed. At least in my version, there's a few scenes where they had snow, but maybe that's more like particulate falling out of the sky.
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was snow or just dust or smoke or something from a fire. There were a lot of fires in this movie, so I didn't know what that was.
I do feel a little bit the rain, like maybe they're thinking about, you know, oh, with climate change, the tropics move up. But I'm not sure I want to give them that much credit. I feel like they might be thinking about, because there's this very strong Asian influence that comes across in the way that they set up the sets and all of that stuff. I think they might be thinking more about Southeast Asia, where it rains a lot, and implicitly importing the rain from there, even though, yeah, not in LA.
Yeah, there was that really distinct Asian influence, but you know, you can have an Asian influence without physically moving yourself from LA to Hong Kong. To me, that ended up being a bit of a science gripe. It just took me a bit out of the movie.
I can see that. I can see that.
The other thing was it was dark. It was so dark. Like you never saw the sun, except for maybe that one scene in Terrell's office where you could see the solar disk behind a very hazy atmosphere. And so the only thing I could think is they were trying to mimic what 40 years of you know, increased smog in LA would look like. Because LA was very well known in the 70s and 80s for having a terrible smog layer. My husband said when he went there as a kid, his eyes would burn. It was terrible. And it's gotten better over the years. And so maybe they thought just get worse and worse and worse. But I still don't think 40 years of smog would make it as dark as they portrayed it in the movie. And John, I think you did a bit of a deep dive into this question.
Well, it's not like that smog builds up over time either, right? It's something that gets formed every day in Los Angeles. You have this photochemical smog from the chemicals that get emitted principally from automobiles, and they get trapped in this thing that we call a temperature inversion. It's really sharp at the top. It's kind of neat. I don't know, Catherine, if you've ever had the experience of flying into LAX, and then you can sort of see this brown wave that comes over the wings as you hit the top of that layer. It's really a neat effect if you do that coming in over land, usually around sunset.
I've flown into LAX, but I don't recall ever seeing that. Maybe the smog has lessened in the years since I've flown into LA.
I can only hope so. But the other thing is that the smog, there's really no way for it to get so thick that it's going to turn, you know, light into darkness. I mean, when we think about that, comparing light into darkness, the moonlight that we get at nighttime is about 400,000 times less bright than the sun is during the day. And if you're going to do that with particles that absorb perfectly, which smog doesn't, then you need something like 13 optical depths, which is like almost three times as thick as the Titanian atmosphere around Saturn's moon Titan, which is a lot of smog. And smog particles, given their size, they don't tend to absorb all the light that hits them. They tend to do this thing called scattering, where they redirect the light into different directions. It's the same effect as when you get dust on your windshield and you drive into the sun and you get blinded by all that.
That just happened to me this morning. It's so hard to drive.
Absolutely. So the light just keeps on going. So instead, you get this kind of more milky effect, and usually with whatever colors are being absorbed. So you get that sort of, you know, brownish, yellowish, greenish, even if you're talking about London. In the UK, they get the traditional pea soups over there, which is smog mixing with fog. So yeah, it's hard to get that kind of thing. Even if you've got a thunderstorm, you're talking about like 100 optical depths from particles that don't send the light forward into your eyes. So yeah, the turning of the day into night is a bit of an exaggeration, I think.
Yeah, it sounded like they primarily did this because they were on a budget. And so they wanted a way to make a bleak, futuristic appearance without a lot of money because they were using a lot of cheap materials. So if everything was dark and in smoke and rain, then they could kind of cover up some of those imperfections. So I don't think they were really thinking about the science when they made this decision, but more about the budget.
It's true, although I have heard that there's supposed to be some significance to the fact that Tyrell's office is the only place that sees the sun. Mm. And we'll probably come back to the size and the scope of that building later on. But even in modern day LA, the inversion layer is only about 1,000 feet up. So if you go to the top of the Library Tower, I think it has a new name now, but it will always be the Library Tower for me. You can get on top of the smog and you can actually see it sitting down in the city.
Gross. So the other vaguely sciencey thing they did in this movie was the whole empathy test. And we'll talk about that a little bit later during Science Shine. But the one thing that really bothered me is they would take out this very complicated looking device to try to test whether or not somebody was a replicant, an android. And then they would just kind of try to focus it on their eyes. But the character would just keep moving around. And yet their eye stayed perfectly centered in this empathy device, which I found a bit distracting. What did you think of that, John?
I feel like we need Peter Brown on the podcast for this one because he's got those telescopes that track incoming meteors and that move lightning quick. If you had really good optical tracking and autofocus, maybe, but it didn't really look like you had the darting around, did you?
Yeah. They also had these really advanced enhancement techniques for photos, which I found a really unrealistic. It's kind of a joke, right? In movies and television, they'll just say enhance, enhance, and the photo magically gets sharper and more focused and more zoomed in, even though in reality, when you take a photograph, it has a set resolution. And so if you keep zooming in, it'll just get fuzzier and blobbier and you'll be able to see less, not more. I guess there is some new advancements in photography that could allow for something like this, but I'm pretty sure they didn't have anything like that in 1982. So it also was a bit distracting to me.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, because it looks like these are analog photos and not digital photos.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had the opportunity to work a little bit with a type of film called TechPan back during my PhD. this is originally designed for the military for U-2 spy planes, but it got a second life in astronomy. And it's really, really fine-grained film. Each little piece of silver in there is 2.5 microns on a side. So if you had what looked like a 4x6, like in the movie, corners unclipped, of course, you're talking about 40,000 by 60,000 pixels, which is enormous. So you could probably go in a fair bit if this was something that was shot in an analog mode with TechPan. But at the same time, the thing that drove me crazy about this particular thing, and it is a Blade Runner trope, is the idea that he's able to navigate around objects and corners and whatnot.
I was like, how is he seeing that?
Yeah. Not with this wavelength, you can't.
Well, or you'd have to take, like, maybe if you took it from, like, multiple perspectives, like if you had several cameras. I guess there is a new development where you can take different photos simultaneously with a range of focus settings. So maybe you could do something similar with, like, the same photo simultaneously with different directions, you know, kind of like a stereo image. So I don't know. They must have some really impressive photographic technology in the Blade Runner world for this to be realistic.
Even though it looks like this just, you know, came out of the machine at Fujifilm in 92.
It does. It looks like you went to like CVS and printed something out of a box there. I did appreciate seeing photos, as we'll talk about. That's very of its time, right? Nobody would be distributing photos. Although I rewatched Blade Runner 2049 because, you know, for research purposes. And they did have like really fancy photos. Like they were printed out on a piece of paper or something, but you could tell they were kind of holographic. So I think they were trying to mimic the look of the original series while also making it more techie in the process.
Yeah, I think we'll get to this more when we talk about the of its time, but I think it's interesting. I mentioned Denis Villeneuve having remade these movies or done sequels to them. You know, this is somebody who's a fan of the original work, who's seen all the mythology, and sometimes is kind of feeding that a little bit, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, you said Blade Runner has a vibe. Blade Runner 2049 also has a vibe, I would say. Mm. And I kind of like its vibe a bit better. And I don't know if that's because it's 35 years older, so, you know, the technology has advanced and so the film looks better. But I kind of like what they did with that movie, perhaps a bit more. But again, maybe that's just my bias showing through.
Oh, tell us what you really think, Ryan Gosling or Harrison Ford?
It depends on the year.
Fair point.
We'll say that. Harrison Ford in 2017 is old, obviously. But, you know, back in 1982, you know, there's a fair comparison to be made between the two.
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed. All right. So another thing, they didn't really talk about this in the movie, but you could sort of pick it up through the implications they were making. And that is that basically all animals are extinct in 2019. That's one of the premises of the movie. When Decker goes to talk to the singer with the snake, he asks her, you know, is your snake real? And she's like, God, no, I can't afford that. Implying that there aren't a lot of real animals around.
There's a similar scene with Rachel, right, where he asks about, I think it's a leather wallet. And she says, oh my goodness, I would go to the police immediately if I found out someone had that.
Right. And the owl in Tyrell's office, too, they make the point it's not a real owl. Everything is, they're like replicant animals. And that's the norm in 2019. So that's implying that basically all animals are extinct by now, which would be tough to do. So I found the World Wildlife Foundation has a site that estimates, you know, how many animals are going extinct due to human-caused extinction. And they put that rate at about 0.01 to 0.1% per year, which is a lot. That's a lot. But to kill off every animal between 1982 and 2019, you'd have to kill off maybe 3 million species a year, which is 3%. So that's 300,000 times higher than the natural background extinction rate, which to me seems improbable. I mean, obviously we are harming the planet through our use of fossil fuels and various other environmental disasters that are happening. But to kill off that many animals per year seems a little hard to believe.
I mean, plus if you actually manage to kill off every single animal on the Earth, you'd probably end up with some kind of ecosystem collapse and we wouldn't be here either. It's an interesting thing that comes up in some of this discussion that takes place in the 70s and the early 80s. I'm reading, by the way, The High Frontier right now. This is about creating off-world colonies using only the species that we like as human beings. And I feel like we now know that that probably isn't going to work.
No, yeah, you need a diverse ecosystem to support a biosphere, right? It can't just be humans and rocks, right? You need a whole bunch of, like, think about the food that we eat, right? We need bees to pollinate it. We're just all interrelated, and you can't kill off every species and yet somehow have humans left over. Although, to be fair, in this movie, they are implying that a lot of people have left Earth for off-world colonies. So maybe there's only a handful of people left on Earth.
It's true. You mentioned in some of the notes here talking about J.F. Sebastian, and he's asked the question by press, why are you still here on Earth? And he talks about how his medical condition prevents him from leaving. But it's kind of a weird medical condition, isn't it?
Yeah, he calls it Methuselah syndrome and implies that it makes him age more rapidly than he should normally. Although that's a weird name for that syndrome, because Methuselah lived a really long time, and he's implying that he's going to die really early. So in reality, it's a syndrome called progeria, which is a real syndrome which causes children to age very rapidly and die at a young age. It's just a terrible genetic condition. And he says that he's 25 years old, but most people with progeria die earlier than that. It's not out of the question that you would live longer than that. I found an article about a 40-something-year-old woman with progeria who's thought to be the oldest person with that condition. And she said her mother had a less severe form of it and lived to 75. So, I mean, I'm no geneticist. I don't know all the details here, but most people with this condition die before their 20th birthday. And when they do, they look a lot older than some guy in his 30s or 40s. So I don't know what kind of condition he was supposed to have, but it doesn't seem to fit with any known condition we have currently.
And even if he got to the off-world colonies, I can't imagine that they would be in very good shape. One thing that continues to surprise me about this movie, it was made in 82, and they only set their world 37 years in the future.
Right.
Like, basically, it's the time period since the Second World War in the future, and they imagine all of these planets with off-world colonies. And there's confusion in the movie about, you know, is it in our solar system? Is it in another solar system? It takes time to put these things together, even if the magic technology to do that colonization showed up in 1983. I don't know that they would be ready for
right.
a big chunk of the world's population to go.
Yeah, I guess they were just really excited about the space shuttle. And they're like, well, we've got a space shuttle now. We can go anywhere.
It's going to fix everything.
But if you want to read about how hard it is to develop a colony, I would strongly encourage you to read A City on Mars by the Wienersmiths. I had the chance to meet Kelly Wienersmith earlier this year, and she gave a talk on their work. And it just, I'm convinced that it's almost impossible to have a feasible human settlement on Mars anytime soon. And so, and even it would have been even less practical back in the 80s. My understanding is from the book. So this movie, we haven't mentioned yet, is based on a book called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep by Philip K. Dick. And I think in his book, most humans were living on Mars. So that was the off-world colony. They were more vague about it in the movie. And then there was just a handful of people left on Earth. But even Mars, which is, you know, one of our closest neighbors, is a heck of a place to live. It has no atmosphere, really, no appreciable atmosphere. You'd have to live underground in bunkers to protect yourself from the radiation from the sun. It's covered in poisonous compounds, like something called perchlorate, that would make it very difficult to farm. And then you're led to all the problems with people living long-term on lower gravity. Mars has about one-third the gravity of Earth. Is it possible for humans to live in such an environment for long periods of time? Is it possible for people to have children in such an environment? These are just all things that people kind of hand wave over when they're talking about off-world settlement. But you can't. You have to think about all these details. And when you do think about all these details, you find that it's very, very difficult to live anywhere else than Earth. So we really should put some effort into preserving the only habitable planet in our solar system.
Definitely. And I too have read A City on Mars. Can't recommend it more. Even if you are a dyed-in-the-wool human multiplanetary species person, you should read this, if for no other reason, to have your beliefs tested.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was already kind of on their side, but reading it just confirmed my suspicions that colonizing other worlds would be very, very difficult.
Well, speaking of things that aren't really called out very well in this movie, the giant buildings. So Catherine and I both went online and we both, you know, looked at our screens with rulers and things like that. And the buildings are big. How big is a good question. It seems like it varies from somewhere in the neighborhood of half a kilometer to 2.5 to 3 kilometers high. And the scale is ridiculous. They didn't plan anything for this. The art department didn't create models that had any kind of realism to them. And there are folks out there who suggest that Tyrell's office is actually 700 stories up. So if you do the math on that, you have an absolutely stupendous building. It's three times the height of the largest building today, but it's also designed kind of like an Egyptian pyramid. And it feels like Tyrell's office has that kind of monumental, very Luxor type of scale to it. So I went ahead, I did the math, I did the nerdy thing here. And right now, if you go with the higher value, then the footprint of each one of these buildings is like 9 kilometers by 9 kilometers, which is bigger than all of downtown Los Angeles today. Like the part that's bounded by Interstate 10, the 110 and the 101 freeways, that's about 5 kilometers wide. So these buildings barely fit in the LA basin to begin with. And then if they are actually solid, like if they actually have offices and things all the way through them, then they've got something like 500 million square feet of usable office space. For comparison, Tokyo, which has the most office space of any city on Earth, only has about 1 billion and a little bit square feet. So there's enough room in those two buildings to have about 5 billion corporate drones working. So I guess a lot of people must still be on Earth to require that much space.
Yeah, I guess,
in, you know, some,
I guess that's why LA doesn't have a housing problem anymore, as one of the characters mentions, if you have that much space. All this empty space, apparently.
Who knows what they're storing in there?
I don't know where they got that number, though. So this number of Tyrell's office being 700 stories tall, it shows up a lot online, but I could not find anyone explaining where they got it from. One person tried to do the math, I think based on, was it a comment in the movie that it was 6 city blocks in size? Something like that, and came up with a much smaller number, like 150 stories. So this is a problem in science, right? People just see a number and they recite it without actually finding the original citation for where this comes from. And you have to be very careful with that, right? If you don't know where it comes from, it could just be a lie, right? And now you're just propagating this lie that somebody just wrote one time for unknown reasons, and now it just gets populated. I was able to find some more details about Blade Runner 2049, because I think they paid a little bit more attention to their miniatures in that movie, and they had thought about the relative scale of the building compared to reality. And in that case, so Tyrell obviously dies in this movie, so a new guy named Wallace takes over, and his building is 3.5 kilometers high. So that is very, very high. But for Blade Runner, I could not find any original source citing why Tyrell's office was 700 stories high. So yeah, just, you know your sources, know where your data is coming from, and just be careful when you're making these assumptions.
The problem with pre-internet stuff, I tell you, definitely when they pull back and you see other skyscrapers that look like toys next to these things, it's unquestionably a stupendously, absurdly large structure.
But why 700 stories? Where does that come from? I could not figure it out. And I did a little bit of digging. I think you did too, right?
Fair enough. I did. I tried, but I didn't go too deep, because it's, you know, always entertaining to, you know, see what they've imagined without thinking of the consequences. You know, that's why we have this show, really.
That's right.
And
we think of the consequences for you.
Oh, yes, yes. If I may, you know, like, kick Blade Runner while it's down just a little bit more before we move on to the science shine. Flying cars.
You can't really
hurt Blade Runner too bad for that, because everyone was doing flying
People
cars.
People loved flying cars.
Oh my.
They seem very impractical, really, though, right? Like, now you're instead, yeah. I mean, people get into enough accidents with the two-dimensional roads we have. Can you imagine how many accidents people would get into if you have like the third dimension and people are just driving like maniacs? Ugh.
Hey, maybe they're self-driving, you know, flying cars.
I guess, but these ones clearly weren't. Well, I guess there was somebody in the driver's seat. I guess I don't know if the computer was driving the car for them or not.
That's true. Unclear. And when you get out into that rain, you better have your lightsaber umbrella with you.
I'd miss these. I'm not sure what you're talking about. Were they just like umbrellas with neon on them?
Yeah, they just had like a fluorescent tube, you know, from the handle to the top. Again, the look, right?
It is a look. Yeah, there was a lot of neon in this movie. So why not for your umbrella?
There you go. So we're going to invoke the mercy rule here, and we're going to move on to the science shine. We'll be back in just a minute. Thank you. All right, welcome back. So this is the part of the show where we talk a little bit about the things that we like with the science. And I think both of us picked up on one of the atmospheric things, just to mirror the science gripes, the fires, the little flame-offs of methane that we see in that opening sequence and whenever they're flying around high over the city. So tell us a bit about this, Catherine.
Right. So this is this very iconic opening shot. It was so iconic that Ridley Scott, the director, made the title screens blank. So nothing would distract from that really cool initial shot you have of LA. You're flying over LA. You see it's dark. You see all these buildings and you see these flames just shooting off, which are usually associated with oil refineries. These are called flare stacks. They're used to burn excess gas, typically made during the refinery process. But I guess the large pulses of flame we see are pretty unusual and probably would indicate a problem in the process. So, you know, they weren't too careful in their oil refinery in LA. And at first I was like, is this real? Like, could you have oil refineries in LA? And I looked it up, and sure enough, there's a huge oil field located in downtown Los Angeles. It was discovered in 1890. They had a couple of successful wells, and at one point it was the top producing oil field in California, accounting for more than half of the state's oil in 1895. So I don't know why they decided to build a city there if they were producing so much oil in that area, but it seems legit that you would have all these oil derricks in LA.
It's a little crazy. And one of the things I enjoy, because I kind of enjoy urban architecture, is just this idea that if you were to walk around LA, of course, nobody walks in LA, as the song says, but drive around LA, there are all of these buildings that are actually hiding oil derricks all throughout the city. It's just like here in Toronto, we have a lot of little electrical substations that look like houses and office buildings to hide that kind of equipment. So that's really neat. And if you ever go out and visit the La Brea Tar Pits, and there's some great science museums there, you'll hear about how a material mined from that was used to pave the roads of Los Angeles, the tar that came from that area. So an area rich in hydrocarbons, and, you know, still in 2019, apparently.
Yeah, good Titan analog. So that was the moon we were comparing it to earlier, which is covered in smog and hydrocarbons. So yeah, they really are trying to replicate that Titan look.
Absolutely. Now, in the science gripes, we talked a little bit about the Voight-Kampff test, and there are parts of this that are not the greatest, but there's also parts of this that seem a little bit better. So something that I noticed with this one was that they were looking for pupil dilation. This is something that actually does get used in filmmaking. And in fact, Ridley Scott had been a filmmaker working in the commercial industry, making advertisements for quite a while. So he probably knew about this, that you often will intentionally film things darker so that the actors have dilated pupils, because that simulates the idea of desire, and people want to see other people desiring things so that they can desire them too and then buy them from those. But here it's being used as a marker of empathy. And I think you did a bit of a deep dive on this one, Catherine.
Well, yeah. So the Voight-Kampff test is kind of interesting because it's pretty unique. They're using it to try to suss out the replicants, the androids. And so in that way, it's kind of like a Turing test. This idea comes from the famous mathematician Alan Turing's 1950 paper, in which he proposed a test called the imitation game, which would tell whether or not a computer could mimic a human. So he starts this paper with, "I propose to consider the question, can machines think?" And so they're trying to, like, you know, differentiate an android, a computer, from a human. And so the Turing test is basically, it has a human evaluator with two people it's talking to. It can't see them, but it's trying to evaluate whether or not they're human or they're a computer. So if it cannot reliably tell them apart, that computer has basically passed the Turing test. And this is something people have been trying to do for decades. You know, does my computer pass the Turing test? And it did in limited ways for many, many years, but it seems pretty clear now that we have large language models like ChatGPT that can pass the Turing test. So within the past few years, we now have computers that can pass the Turing test. So part of this test seems to mimic that Turing test, but the other half seems to be like a polygraph, like a lie detector, because they're using these physiological responses to questions to determine whether or not a person is a replicant or not. In addition to the eye dilation, it also looks at respiration, blush response, heart rate, eye movement, trying to deal with whether or not the individual is showing any empathy. I thought it was interesting that Philip K. Dick came up with this idea when he was researching World War II Gestapo documents for another book, The Man in the High Castle, and realized that there were reports of these Nazi soldiers who just had no empathy. You know, they could hear the cries of starving children and just not react at all. And so he thought that maybe empathy was this key part of being human, and a replicant wouldn't show empathy while a human would. And so the idea is that you could use the sort of like polygraph test to tell whether or not the person was a human or not. I did think it was funny. I was reading up on this, and apparently in 2003, they kind of came up with their own version of the Voight-Kampff test and applied it to the mayoral candidates for the city of San Francisco. And, and proved that at least half of them would be classified as replicants. So you can be safe in the knowledge that the city of San Francisco is being run by an android, probably to this day. So yeah, it's an interesting test. It does have some basis in actual scientific ideas. I'm not sure how exactly it works, but you know, there's some science there. What were your thoughts, John?
Oh, definitely. Although I have to say, in rewatching it, for some reason when I was younger, I thought that these were mechanical robots. You know, that the replicants were. But now rewatching it, it seems more clear that they're actually clones. And sort of like the base function of the human brain relies on emotion. Something like this that's trying to differentiate the replicant from the human, doing that on the basis of emotion, I would imagine that with the replicants, you might risk having a stronger emotional response. And in fact, a lot of the movie is about the replicants growing into that emotional response. So I'm not sure, like, you're right, it has science, but I'm not sure it is self-consistent with the universe that it's in.
Yeah, fair. I mean, in the follow-up movie, Blade Runner 2049, we see Rachel's skeleton. She looks very human. So it does seem like they're basically organic creatures. I'm not exactly sure what makes them an android, to be sure, and they don't ever really explain it. But it is interesting that they, you know, narrowed in on this idea of empathy as being a characteristic human trait, even though Dick himself, you know, pointed out that some people are incapable of feeling empathy. So, and as you're pointing out, if you're an organic robot, why wouldn't you feel empathy, right? If you also have a brain, it seems like that wouldn't be the differentiator you would want for this sort of test.
Well, I mean, according to Pris, I think, therefore I am, and you're done.
That's right. I mean, how do you determine sentience, right? And, you know, just go back to Descartes. That was his idea, is that if you're conscious, if you know you're alive, you think, therefore you are, you're alive. So I think when you get to the point where you can create an organic robot, like the replicants or like the Cylons from last week, they're a life form. I wouldn't call them some sort of substandard form of life. They're just as human as we are, in a way. More human than human, I think, is a point they make in the sequel.
And this is the way we operate as scientists, right? The Turing test is not saying whether or not the robot or the computer is alive. It's just, can we tell the difference? And we see the same thing in the Drake equation too, looking for technological civilizations being defined as ones that can create a radio telescope. So trying to break it down from any of our concepts of what this is into something that's measurable and testable.
Right. Although, you know, obviously the Turing test has its limitations too. It's dependent on the qualitative assessment of a human evaluator. People have different biases and different ways of looking at things. So it's more, I guess you would just have a lot of different human evaluators and see how many of them pick out the robot and how many don't.
Well, that's why Deckard's so good, because maybe he's a replicant too. He knows them from the inside.
That's right. That's right. So we talked about these robots being organic. They certainly seem organic. They seem human in that way in the movie. I think they were really touching on this idea of genetic engineering that was just barely started in the 70s and 80s. So I think in that way, they were pretty forward-looking, that you could use genetic engineering to adapt an organism, which has really taken off in the last few decades since this movie was made. And so there, I think they were kind of ahead of their time. John, what were your thoughts on that aspect of the movie?
I was thinking about this in the context of Star Trek and any kind of science fiction that's trying to predict the future. There are going to be some things that they get right and some things that they get wrong. We have a segment at the end of the show where we punish people for the things they got wrong when we look at how well things have held up. But with Star Trek, famously, things like faster than light travel, like the transporters, you know, we're nowhere near getting those. We haven't really advanced towards those since the show was on 70 years ago. But things like computer technology, we've got better computers than the Enterprise has now today. We have better ways of communicating with each other than the Enterprise has in the future as well. And I think this one suffers from a little bit of that as well. It's very difficult to predict the future. So like no flying cars, obviously, but it's amazing the strides that have been made in terms of understanding the genome, being able to do things using genetic engineering in ways that this one didn't even think about. It has one scene that you picked up on and I saw as well, because it doesn't fit when they tried to do this technobabble thing and they mentioned a bunch of compounds and, you know, ways you might edit somebody. And it just seems so basic. But at the same time, because genetic engineering has some parallels in computing, you had this huge advance over 30 years between 1990 and 2020. In 1990, the Human Genome Project was expected to take decades. It was expected to cost billions of dollars. And the first one was really hard. It took 13 years. But now we can do genetic sequencing of an entire human genome in 2 weeks for $1,000. The coronavirus was sequenced, what was it, within, I think, a week or two, maybe not even that long, of the start of the pandemic in 2020. A lot of times we have the capability of doing Blade Runner-y things. It's just that we choose not to.
Yeah, the other big advancement is this idea of CRISPR, which was developed in 2012, so 30 years after this movie was made. And this is a technique that was designed to really easily alter the genome of almost any organism. I mean, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a biochemist, I don't know all the details, but basically they can kind of like snip a gene at a specific place. It can remove genes, you can add new ones while the creature is still alive, I'm pretty sure. And so it's been really significant in biotechnology and medicine, as well as in agriculture, in creating genetically modified organisms, which can control, you know, pests and pathogens and improve our ability to grow food. So it's been a really influential technique, so much so that by 2020, the people who had developed this technique won the Nobel Prize. And so not only do we understand the genome better now, we also understand how to change it in a way that, yeah, they probably had no idea would happen in 1982. So their idea of genetic engineering doesn't look like what it was in the movie. We're not creating eyeballs and inserting them into robots. But there, you know, I think there was some prescience there in how influential genetic modification would be in the future.
But one thing I really did like there's one place where they actually got it completely right, totally by accident. And this was something that we picked up, you know, Catherine and I messaging before the show, looking at that scanning electron microscope in one of the vendor's stalls that looked like, oh, it's the size of an oscilloscope. That can't possibly be right. So I went and took a look at vendors of SEMs, and there is one that's about size that you can just buy.
Yeah. They were trying to tell, Deckard found this scale in a bathtub, and he was trying to figure out where it was from. And so he took it to the street vendor. That would be pretty cool. You just go to a street vendor and ask for a very high resolution microscopic image of your target. We don't do that. Although I could see that in like some sort of capitalist future where all the science is a pay for play kind of service. It's kind of how it seemed like in the Blade Runner universe. One fun fact, when they were looking at it under the microscope, it wasn't actually a snake scale. It was a bud of marijuana. So if you're curious what they're actually looking at, it's not snakes.
You're right that we don't typically see these big biotech companies having a kiosk at the mall.
But maybe we will in the future, right? I mean, talking about genomes, you can send your DNA to 23andMe and have them sequence your genome, right? Although I guess there was a big data breach recently. So I've never done this. I don't want to have anyone having control over my genome. So, you know, up to you whether or not you decide to use these services. But it is a service for fee that you can access.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when it comes to things like livestock, you know, there's a lot of cloning that happens there. You even see it a little bit with pets for those people who are willing to pay. And we are in a time, I should say, where we could do artificial selection on ourselves.
Yes.
It's just
there are ethics
most people
of that.
Do not.
Yeah, there's some ethical concerns there. And I mean, to be fair, we've been genetically modifying ourselves and our pets and whatnot for hundreds of years, right? Before any of this fancy biotechnology was developed, simply by selective breeding, right? You have two dogs, you like the look of them, they have a puppy. Now you have, you know, your genetically modified dog. It's just we've gotten better at doing it, I would say, of late, right? There's less variables. You can do it more precisely now.
That's right. And really, really peculiar things like taking a gene from a firefly or a gene from a bacteria and splicing it into, you know, a corn plant, whereas you never would have gotten there. We can make the corn bigger. We can make the gray wolf more docile. But now we can do things that were unbelievable in Blade Runner time.
Right. Still, you shouldn't be concerned about genetically modified organisms. They're not going to harm you if you eat them, right? I know there was this big concern about GMOs. People are like, oh, I can't eat a GMO. They're just organisms, right? They're not going to make you sick. So I wouldn't be too concerned about that. I think the ethics are where the concerns really bother me more than the actual physical product of these genetically modified organisms.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to touch on, Catherine, before we leave this section?
Yeah, just one thing. So they made this point that the replicants can only live 4 years. And that reminded me a lot of the planned obsolescence that a lot of technology companies work into their products, right? Apple wants you to keep buying iPhones. So they make sure that your iPhone is going to break or not be able to update in, you know, 4 or 5 years. And then you have to buy a new one. So I know they were doing it for different reasons in this movie. I think they were concerned that replicants would develop empathy and then like rise up against their masters. And so that's why they had this fixed timeline. But yeah, it's something that companies do in the present day as well. And for similarly nefarious reasons, right? They want you to keep spending your money.
It's true. Now that you say it, though, it reminds me of some of the things that we do breed, because, of course, this is planned obsolescence of a biological creature, right? And there are actually crops out there that are designed that are incapable of reproducing.
That's true.
They're sterile. And the same with insects as well, that are used for the screwworm population in Central America.
Yeah. Or even mules, right?
Yes, yes.
You know, donkey horse hybrids, right, are incapable of reproducing. So we've been doing this for a while. They also have, I guess, planned obsolescence in their own fashion.
All right. Well, let's take another little break and we'll be right back with the Of Its Time section. All right, welcome back. So this is the part of the show where we talk a little bit about what situates this movie in time. And we've had trouble with this section in the past. I don't think we're going to have too many problems today.
Yeah, this was like the most 80s movie I've seen in a while. And as I said, I watched Indiana Jones very recently. So but this movie just screamed 80s to me. So it was filmed in the spring and summer of 1981, so around the time I was born. And then it was released about a year later on June 25th, 1982. As I mentioned, that was just 2 weeks after E.T. came out. So kind of a tough market to come out in. It was based on a 1968 novel, though, Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Dick died in March of 1982, so right before the film was released. But it sounds like he saw some early cuts and liked it. So, you know, it has the author's stamp of approval on it. And then it was directed by Ridley Scott, who a lot of people know from the movie Alien, which was another very, you know, late 70s, early 80s movie.
So what always gets me with ones in the 70s and the 80s is that the directors and the art directors are always just so impressed with the CRTs and the computers that they've got. They can't wait to put them on screen and because it just shouts technology. And looking back at it from 2025, oh my goodness.
So anachronistic. Yeah, we'd never have a giant CRT monitor with these very pixelated graphics on them today. So it really does, you know, say this film was made in the 80s, right? Because even by the 90s, well, I guess you get a little bit of this in the 90s, but they started to move away from those massive pixels, the limited colors. Yeah, they want it to be, like John said, look very techie, but in the end, it looks very out of date.
It is interesting because I hate to bring up Star Trek again, but this is something they get right by actually going and making acetate overlays, you know, that are back illuminated rather, or doing it later on in post-production rather than trying to have the computer in the scene a lot of the time.
Yeah, Star Trek did a much better job of predicting what future computers would look like. They even had their little iPads. Now they had like many of them, you know, one iPad for every function. But yeah, even though it was also made in the 80s, Star Trek TNG looks a lot more like the future than this movie did.
Now, of course, we're always picking on this, the smoking everywhere. But in this one, because it's a detective story, we also have to have excessive drinking at work, too.
Yes. Yeah. Everyone was smoking. I guess the police chief was drinking in his office. Yeah. The smoking, I noticed the smoking more than the drinking, but I don't think you'd have that much smoke around. your work location in 2019 as they were predicting in 1982. I certainly would have rage quit if people were smoking next to me in my office.
Now, of course, here, I'm not sure if the worst air quality is indoors or outdoors.
That's right. That's right. Maybe it's a six of one, half a dozen of the other. You have to wear a mask inside and out. And the other thing that really stood out to me was kind of horrifying was in that first scene with in the chief's office, they actually use the N-word. I haven't heard that in a movie ever. So I don't know how common it was even in 1982. And I know it was used in a negative light, but I just can't imagine anyone saying that word today or in 2019. It really stood out as really of its time.
It's a strange thing to imagine porting forward into the future when they spent so much time on developing that city speak, for instance. It really seems a little bit discordant there.
Yeah, that's right. So this was actually apparently designed by Edward James Olmos, who plays Gaff. So we have two Edward James Olmos starring roles here in 2 weeks in a row. But yeah, he had this idea that, you know, with the multicultural composition of Los Angeles, that maybe we wouldn't just all speak in English anymore. Maybe we'd incorporate bits of Spanish and Asian languages and kind of all mix it together in what he called city speak. So, you know, EGO was very forward looking, I think, in what he thought Los Angeles would become. So it makes this scene even more out of place.
Well, with the smoking and the drinking and the racism, I think that we really need to talk about that romance scene, which is kind of hard to watch, you know,
it is.
Sitting where we are sitting.
Yeah, there's this scene where I guess Decker is trying to seduce Rachel or anyways, but she's trying to leave and he slams the door on her so she can't leave. Like, it doesn't seem like she's really into him and he's trying to prevent her from leaving. And so the whole thing seems kind of non-consensual, which I didn't love, even though there's like this, you know, wailing saxophone in the background telling me it's supposed to be this romantic scene. And the whole thing just felt kind of off. And when I was reading some background about the movie, it turns out that I guess Harrison Ford accidentally pushed the actress Sean Young a little too hard during that scene. And so she was actually horrified. So that was real fear in her eyes. I don't think Harrison Ford was trying to do that, but it came off as this really uncomfortable scene, not romantic at all, kind of rapey. I didn't like it.
I'm with you 100% there. And you're right. It does feel that way. Like the music behind it makes no sense. And for whatever reason, the way that the actors play it, they play it as non-consensual and like an assault almost. Well, not almost, like it is. Yeah, it's hard to watch, and it just colors that whole interaction between those two characters.
Right, because it's supposed to be this like great romance, and they, you know, leave together at the end, and you know, you find out later they had a child together and blah, blah, blah. So it's supposed to be romantic, but I never got that romantic vibe between them. And especially not in that scene. So I don't know if it was the writing or directing, the acting, but something was just off there. I think at the time, right, people had different views on romance too. So I've been rewatching Star Trek The Next Generation, and there's similar episodes where they're like trying to say, oh, this is romantic. But to me, it just seems really off. So I think there were some more patriarchal leanings in the 80s that led them to present romance in a certain way that nobody would do today.
Yeah, I have a feeling that when this came out in 1982, that people might have read it differently than we do today.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Well, speaking of things that are a little bit rickety and not quite what they seem, a lot of the vehicles in this movie give a strong resemblance to a vehicle that's currently around, and not by Eldon Tyrell, a different Eldon or someone with a similar name, perhaps.
Yeah, so I was surprised to read that Elon Musk's design of the Cybertruck, Tesla Cybertruck, was inspired by this film. I guess that jives. It's a really ugly truck and looks perhaps more like, yeah, this weird futuristic dystopia than an actual car you would drive in 2025. And apparently the film's art designer was flattered by the homage. I don't know. To me, it just looks ugly. And I appreciate the ties to Blade Runner, but like maybe there was a reason people didn't model their cars after what we saw in Blade Runner.
Hey, it's not accurate to me unless it's got the scissor doors. That's
right.
Just,
well, and
you know,
don't,
it's just missing.
Don't some Teslas have scissor doors? I think I've seen that, right?
Oh, the Gullwing doors on,
oh,
Gullwing. On one of them,
okay.
I think.
Yeah. People like, and I know they did this with like Back to the Future too. All their cars had these doors that, yeah, go up and down. And it just seems really impractical. And as you can tell, most cars just have a normal, you know, open and shut, you know, nothing fancy. What's the expression? Like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? I don't know why we need a fancy door.
Oh, I'm with you, and you know, if I was less focused on this movie, this is the point where I would complain about the door handles on the Cybertruck and on all of the electric vehicles now, which are just painful to use compared to something that
mechanical.
You know, I know. But what can you say? Some people just can't wait for the future.
Yeah, well, and apparently they couldn't wait for the future either, the people who made this movie. I was really curious to think why they set LA as such an Asian city. You could tell, like, most of the people there were Asian. There were a lot of Asian billboards. I mean, certainly there is a large Asian population within Los Angeles, but not to the point where everything's written in a language that's not English. And so I looked this up a little bit, and I guess there were a lot of anti-Asian, especially anti-Japan themes in the 70s and 80s, and I think that's where they were playing off of. So during the oil crisis in the 70s, a lot of the American car makers really lost a ton of money, and so Japan made inroads in the US. You know, people started buying Hondas, Toyotas, Nissans, and so I guess the makers of this film thought, oh, well, Japan's going to take over the US, and so it comes from this place of kind of anti-Japanese sentiment that was rife in the 70s and 80s, which is not something I think people would do today.
Now, the one thing I think I will say here is that it could be that this is not meant to be representative of Los Angeles generally, but this is a particular area that Deckard is visiting that tends to have that. When you go to,
like Chinatown,
you know, to Chinatowns, yeah. Exactly. You tend to see less less English around and other things like that. But I have no doubt that this is the influence, right? It's that fear of what's over the ocean a little bit.
Yeah.
But here it's sort of treated as a fait accompli. I mean, with Deckard, he even has a bonsai tree in his in his apartment.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of a strange tack they took with the movie, but that fit, I think, within the culture of the early 80s, but doesn't fit as well anymore.
It does get wrapped up with the trend-setting part of the movie, though, I think, because that's an element that's actually moved with a lot of this sort of film noir. When you look at films set much later, like even things like The Fifth Element, which is in some ways kind of like the anti-Blade Runner because it is so bright and neon and crazy, it also has some of those same elements to it. And you think about some of the major, you know, anime that's been inspired by this, things like Ghost in the Shell. You know, it's interesting that this is a piece that seems to continue along with the rain.
Yeah.
Just saying.
I mean, yeah, we'll get to what we think the influence this movie's had on, you know, society in a bit, but it really did set the standard for these sort of cyberpunk movies, these what we call it, neo-noir cinema. Take what you will from Blade Runner, but it definitely has influenced a lot of future movies and books. I read something about William Gibson, who wrote Neuromancer in 1984. And it turns out he saw the movie in theaters and left 20 minutes in because he was so shocked by how similar it was to the book he was writing. So certainly it has influenced a lot of creative people in the past 40 years.
Well, the last thing I think I'll say with regards to things being of its time, I feel like, you know, Vangelis was having a moment at that time. So you've got a set of films around the early 80s, which have that electronica kind of soundtrack to them that's very forward.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is one of them.
Yeah, and when we were watching Blade Runner 2049, I was like, oh, this sounds a lot like the original, but I think Vangelis was dead by then, so it was a completely different composer for the sequel. But clearly, yeah, he set a tone that other musicians have copied even to the present day.
All right, well, let's leave the future of the past where you could still use a payphone, and we'll go on to the rating section after this.
All right, so this is the part of the show where we rate the movie on its scientific accuracy, its influence, and how it holds up over time. And we do this on a scale of 1 to 5, unless we really hate it, and then we can go down to 0. So let's start with scientific accuracy. John, how would you rank this movie in terms of its scientific accuracy?
So I initially started with something pretty high, but I settled on a 3, which is sort of the middle of the road. The movie, thankfully, does not most of the time explain the crazy stuff that's going on, the science and science fiction aspects of it. They do make that mistake in Tyrell's office, unfortunately. But by and large, there are things that are not too terrible. But again, this is, you know, a very artistic movie. It's doing things for the look. as we talked about with Star Wars, and it does go down some bad pathways there. So I'm putting it sort of in the middle myself.
I ended up giving it a 2, a little lower than John. When I first watched this, my Science Shine category was almost empty of notes. I really had to think about it and think about things I could talk about that would be seen in a positive light. And so I don't know how much of it is due to the movie. Like John said, they didn't really talk about science in it much, and how much of it is just me attributing certain scientific concepts to the movie that they weren't necessarily trying to portray. So the science here is not strong, but as John said, it's not really what they were going for. Okay, let's move on to influence. How has this movie influenced our society, influenced you? Where would you put it on that scale?
So I decided to be a little provocative here, and I'm going to give it the full 5 marks on this one. And part of the reason for that is you have the first real art house, you know, dark kind of science fiction movie that inspired a whole segment of stuff. You're right, not a lot of people went to see it in theaters, but this is something that's come back into theatrical release 7 times. It's got a real audience with people who create other things that people have seen a lot of. So that influence in terms of creating things is there. And just like the little bits of artistry, I love that little piece at the end where instead of it just being a huge fight with Batty and with Deckard, at the end they stop and they have a conversation, and just that idea of wanting to explain themselves before they die, you know, just little stuff like that elevates it to me. And I think that's why the art community in film picked up on this and started to use it in other places as well, not just the look and the feel.
I originally gave it a 3 because I don't have a strong background with this movie. You know, I don't think it made a huge impact on me personally or, you know, the culture. But then as I started reading up on it, I elevated it to a 4 because I think it has had quite an influence on cinema and movies and sci-fi. Just the look of it over the past 40 years has been very influenced by this movie. So I did bump it up a little bit. I'm not going to push it to a 5, just again, because it didn't make a huge impact on my life. but yeah, I can see where it's been an influence on science fiction. I think I might have given away my score for this last category, which is how does it hold up? But John, why don't you tell us about what you rated it?
It's interesting, right? Because this is so much an 80s movie,
so
right?
So much an 80s movie.
Exactly. So that on one hand makes me want to be really harsh on it. Like I sometimes think about how does it hold up as thinking about the timelessness of the property. But at the same time, when I think about the kinds of things that it was proposing and the kinds of things it was dealing with, I feel like there's a certain bit of timelessness in some of those things and other places where it's just completely out to lunch. So this one felt, again, like a mixed bag to me. So I, again, gave it a 3 right down the middle.
I was a little bit harsher. I gave it a 2 because it's just so hard to separate this movie from the time period it was created. So it didn't feel very timeless to me. It felt like it was doing a bad job predicting the future and had a very 80s look to it. And it was really hard to ignore that. And again, maybe it's just because it's a newer movie, but I feel like the sequel, Blade Runner 2049, maybe did a little better job there. But maybe I'll watch it in another decade and be like, gosh, this looks really old. So we'll see. We'll see how that one holds up. But comparing the two next to each other, I do think the look for 2049 was better.
Well, that's the fascinating thing, I think, with speculative fiction and science fiction is really it has more to say about what the people at the time were thinking than about any authentic prediction about the future. And it's fascinating to have this time capsule back to 1982.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, it's seeing a time, you know, when we were alive, but didn't really know what was going on, right? So, but certainly it might have had this unconscious influence on our lives in a way that we don't appreciate.
Indeed. Well, today as we close, dear listener, I invite you to contemplate this. Will all of these podcasts that Catherine and I are making just be lost in time like tears in rain? See you next week. Science is hosted by Catherine Nish and John Moores, with Catherine taking the lead on pre-production, sourcing clips, and writing show notes, and John taking the lead on post-production and sound editing. Artwork for the show is provided by science illustrator Michelle Parsons, while Sean Nock handles web hosting and ensures that our conversations make make their way to your favorite podcasting service.